Future Proof.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. And as you can hear, we are at the Dublin Royal Convention Centre for part of Science Week 2024. And we have a fantastic live audience with us. Say hello. It's great to have you all here. They're taking their time out of their calendars to join me for an event during Science Week. There are still plenty of events happening up and down the country. Check out scienceweek.ie. And this is all with thanks to Research Ireland. So the theme of Science Week this year is regeneration. So that's what we're going to be talking about on this week's programme. What does regeneration look like in the real world? And what does it look like in the virtual world? We've gathered together only the finest experts to explore that. But first, if you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can raise your hand if you are in the room. But if you made the poor decision of not coming to see us in person, you can email us science@newstalk.com or tweet us. We're at Newstalk Science. All of those comments will be in the podcast. We begin, as ever, looking back at the more interesting stories from the world of science this past week. We're joined by the charming, delightful and erudite Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland. And for gender balance, this guy was hanging around outside. It's Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD. He's also a doctor of something, apparently. Shane Bergen! You're both very welcome. So let's get into it. Our first story, Ruth.
Has to do with memory.
Yeah.
Did you ever have that feeling, Jonathan, where it was almost like your body was remembering something? We've talked about like muscle memory, even though we kind of all know that memory happens in our brain. But new research that was just published in Nature Communications suggests maybe there is something else going on in the other cells in our body. So when we form a memory in our brain, we have chemicals called neurotransmitters, and they impact on our neurons, and they turn on genes in our neurons, which help our neurons to form synapses, like hands meeting together, to form the pathways that become our memories. But researchers at NYU decided to look at other cells in the body, and specifically they took nerve cells and kidney cells, and they grew them in the lab on plates, and they exposed them to chemicals that acted a bit like a neurotransmitter. And what they found was pretty surprising, because they found that a gene associated with memory, the same gene that we see in neurons, was activated in these cells. So that was kind of intriguing, but I suppose we couldn't really call that memory as such. But then they decided to look into it in more detail. And when we learn, one of the things that we know is we learn more effectively when we do things in a spaced out way. So, for example, rather than doing all your cramming before an exam, if you actually go back to something a number of times, you're going to retain that better because it allows your brain to have time to solidify those neural connections. And they found the same effect was true in these nerve and kidney cells. So when they gave the same dose of these chemicals that mimic the neurotransmitter, they found that the genes, this gene that is activated in memory, lit up because it was labeled with a fluorescent protein for much longer and in a much stronger way when they gave the training or the learning in a spaced out repetitive way.
What on earth would our kidney need to remember?
Well,
go to the toilet.
indeed, Shane. Yeah. But what would be the purpose of having an ability to remember in something like a kidney?
Well, I guess it's what the researchers have said, and it's a really intriguing thought. Think about all of the things that happen in your body, particularly all the chemicals that touch on every bit of your body, including molecules that are sort of coursing through all our cells as leaving maybe some kind of imprint. So maybe this means that things like how regularly we eat, the things that we do, we are to some extent maybe training other parts of our body with some kind of memory of those activities. I mean, this is kind of, I think it's quite groundbreaking, this work. I know we use that a lot, but nobody ever thought we would find something like this. And like I said, the sort of headline said memory in your kidneys. I mean, I don't think we can say that yet. But I think it is intriguing. And I mean, you've covered on the show many times this idea of the time of day mattering when you get your medications or, you know, when you eat. Does that impact on your blood sugar differently? So maybe there is something going on, and it's not just muscle memory. It's almost cellular memory in all different organs of our body that is impacted on by everything that we do.
Very interesting. Shane, our second story has to do with this amazing organism, the so-called corpse flower. So first, you might need to just remind people what the corpse flower is before you talk about this study.
It's absolutely enormous. It's rare and it smells of rotting flesh. They're so rare. These things only blossom every couple of years, 5 to 7 years. And I just thought, for a PhD student that has to work on something that only happens once every 5 to 7 years, is
it's worse than the drop.
Yeah, it's definition of torture, basically, you know.
But you did work on the pitch drop, right?
Yes, yes.
The pitch drop is the most the most solid liquid in the world, and only drops once every...
Well, in Trinity
now,
it drops every 5 years. The one in Australia, every 10 years. So this is kind of like that, really, but it's a smelly version of it. And so it's a large flower, and it was grown in Dartmouth in the United States. And basically, they were waiting for it to flower. A bunch of PhD students were poised, ready to go, because they want to understand its mechanism. They want to understand what causes the rotten smell, and also what causes the flower to heat up by about 10 degrees above the ambient temperature around it just before it flowers.
So that's a kind of a marker that it's about to flower. So it's not like they'll know it's about to flower.
Exactly, yeah.
And when it flowers, does it flower quickly? Because I get the impression it's sort of like a Little Shop of Horrors sort of thing.
That's what I have in my head too.
And
it's like Feed Me, Seymour, exactly. So this thing is as big as 3.5 meters. So just before it actually opens out, it's at the apex of 3.5 meters above the flower pot, which is remarkable. So they took samples from it and they looked for mechanism, basically, as a botanist tend to do. And they learned an awful lot about the mechanism by trying to understand genetic pathways that may lead to the expression of chemicals that cause the smell. A lot of what they found was what they imagined. And do you know what? That's 99% of science is. We have a hypothesis. We need to go out and find, is that true or not? But they also found a surprise. They found the precursor for a smelly molecule called putrescine, right? Which is just brilliant.
What are the chances that it would be called putrescine?
And what are the chances it smells, right?
Yeah.
A putrescine is something that dead animals excrete when they are starting to rot, right? And that attracts in things that eat rotten flesh, right? So birds, etc. And so they, you know, they get fed. But the plant is clever enough to know that if it gives off this smell, it's able to bring in a very select type of animal that will take away, I suppose, you know, material from the plant and move to another plant, right? And of course, flowers are how plants have sex, right? So they're able to reproduce. What I don't know, and I'm conscious...
I don't think you can say have sex when it's animals, when it's a plant, can you?
Well, reproduce.
Sexual reproduce.
Sexual they don't have sex.
Okay, Jonathan, you'll be technical about this. Right?
I think it's important to be right, and particularly when there's people here. Like, normally we're just in the studio, it doesn't really matter.
Well, what I was thinking, and I'd love to know more, because I couldn't find out online, nor did it mention in the paper, is if something blossoms, right, in order for the sexual reproduction to be complete, there needs to be a male and a female, there needs to be another plant nearby going through the same thing more or less at the same time, just as the bee moves from one flower to the next, pollinating as it goes, right? So how do these plants that blossom so rarely know to blossom at the same time? Because once it opens up, it's only open for a few days.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think it's just remarkable. It probably explains why these things are rare.
Our third story is about tomatoes.
It's about tomatoes and about, again, you might have noticed, people say that a lot of the fruit and vegetables that we have nowadays don't taste as good as they used to. And I think we often find in Ireland, particularly our tomatoes, they don't really hold a candle to the great tomatoes that you get down in the Mediterranean. And this is research that was done in Shenzhen, in China. And these researchers were looking at the wild precursor to tomatoes. So many of our crops that we have today are sort of amped up versions of things that had existed in the wild. And wild tomatoes were much smaller than the tomatoes we have now, but much sweeter. And obviously over the years, farmers have selected for size, because I guess size sells.
Yeah.
So they went back and they compared the genome of wild tomatoes and domesticated tomatoes, which are the tomatoes we all eat, and they found two genes, and these genes act in a cascade, so one gene turns on the next gene, as they often do, but these genes actually act as a brake on sugar production, so they stop the tomato plant from producing sugar. And they found when they modified these exist and they turn off more sugar production in our domesticated tomatoes that we all get, which is why they're not as sweet. So they were able to use CRISPR-Cas9, very specific genetic editing, to turn off these genes so that we would actually see more sugar production. And they were able to produce tomatoes that had 30% more sugar, so they were sweeter, but they didn't really lose a lot of size. They had slightly smaller seeds, but that's to be expected because really the plant is choosing where to put its energy. Is it going to put its energy into becoming succulent and sweet, so a bird comes and takes it away to spread the seeds, or is it going to actually make more healthy seeds? So this is interesting because, you know, we are losing flavor in some of our crops and we now have the prospect of maybe putting it back in.
But if we're using, you know, change this gene to make these tomatoes sweeter, was this particular breed less sweeter before and it's just been bred out? Or why is it not, like, are we making a tomato that never really existed if we make this change?
I mean, traditional breeding, I suppose, has bred gene, has selected for particular genes, and we've selected for size, like we've selected for a lot of muscle.
Like strawberries. So strawberry producers say that basically you buy these huge strawberries, they're awful. What if you, Jimmy Cairns, who sells strawberries beside my wife's home in Wexford, says small strawberries are the tastiest ones, but nobody will buy them.
Yeah, big so glowing red. Yeah, well, there you go. But I mean, I guess one, we are putting more sugar into the food. So I mean, sugar is sugar. But the other question is, you know, are we more like, is it just more palatable? And then are we going to eat more fruit and vegetables if we could use this ton of technology to make them more tasty? I mean, at the moment we can't because it's not allowed. We have pretty strict laws in the EU regulating GM. But a lot of those laws were written at a time when really GM meant taking a gene from another species and moving it to this species. So your question is a really good one because you're sort of saying, could this have existed anyway in the wild if we'd selected slightly differently through traditional breeding?
That's a much better question than I asked, but yeah, sure.
So, you know, we have to have a discussion about these things. We are going to have a discussion about GM and agriculture at some point as we face into a warmer, wetter world.
The whole GM thing, it feels like a kind of an old-fashioned sort of approach now, given how much we know about the use of genetic material in plants and the techniques that we've developed. If we started now, could we develop food that is as good as Mediterranean? Could we do that with lots of different crops, make perfect apples every time? And is that a bad thing?
I don't know if we could make perfect apples every time, but I think the GM that we have now today has a specificity that it certainly did not have when we started having these conversations. So it's like everything. Just because something was right in science 15, 20 years ago doesn't mean it's the best position we have today, which is why we have to continue to have conversations about these things using the most up-to-date information. And, something to be said for tasty tomatoes.
Surprise, surprise, Shane, our final story has to do with dogs.
Yeah, I took my friend Gaston, the guide dog, for a walk today, and he got into the river in Wicklow and got out, and he did what every dog does, which is shake. And he does seem to do it near me and not my wife, which I reckon I have to have words with him. But this story is from the journal Science, which is very reputable. I love that they published a story on this. And it's about the reflex that dogs have for that shaking to lose water. They're not the only animal that does it. So do mice, cats, squirrels, lions, tigers and bears. So surprise, surprise, Jonathan, of that list, what do you think the scientists worked on in this paper?
Bears. Mice?
Mice, exactly. Yeah, so all of these animals do it to expel water, insects and irritants. And what they were looking for, basically, it's a touch thing. It's a sensation thing, but it is a reflex. And they were trying to find out the circuitry. So which neuron was responsible for it? All mammals have 12 types of sensory neurons, including us. And in this study, they focused on one because it wraps around hair follicles. So basically, if somebody touches your hair, you can sense it. For humans, it's normally associated with gentle touch. With animals like mice or dogs, it's normally something, get off me, basically. Yeah, some humans, it's the same. So what they did in the study was they took a drop of sunflower oil and they put it on little mice. And nearly all of the mice shook it off, right? This is why they didn't do it with bears. You need a lot more oil. They then modified the neuron and they were able to basically reduce the amount of mice shaking by 50%. And they then went further and they used something called optogenetics to induce the response. So basically it's using light to switch things on and off. And they're able to basically get the mouse to start involuntarily shaking, which is kind of mean. So they're learning an awful lot about the circuit here, thinking about various skin issues that animals have. Anyone who owns a dog will know that normally the first line of defense for a dog, if they have any sort of response to something, is their skin, right? Yeah. But we tend to have it in our respiratory systems. Dogs tend to have it in their skins in terms of reactions. But what I think could be interesting here, and perhaps not in the dog's best interest, is could we breed dogs in the future that don't do this shake? So when they get out of the river, right, they're not going to come over next to their owner and shake like hell and drench you.
This is the weirdest thing you've ever said. Why would we do that?
Because I get wet a lot from the dog.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ruth Freeman, Dr. Shane Bergen. All right. Coming up, we're going to be talking about regeneration in animals and ecosystems. Stay with us. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're coming to you as part of Science Week 2024. We are in front of a live audience for Science Week with thanks to Research Ireland. And we're talking about regeneration, the theme of this year's Science Week. And the first thing that comes to mind to most people, I imagine, when we think about regeneration is the animal kingdom and the amazing creatures that can lose a limb or a tail and still live to tell the tale. But we also wanted to talk about the places that they live in and need to regenerate them. The ecosystems of our planet. We're joined by Colly Ennis, Science Officer with the Herpetological Society of Ireland, Zoology Research Assistant at Trinity College Dublin, and co-host of the Critter Shed podcast, and Aideen McAdams, who's a PhD student in Trinity College Dublin, researching habitat restoration. Round of applause, please. So, Colly, I have to say, this is our first time actually technically meeting, but I've been following you on Twitter and seeing all of your work with animals, and I find what you do fascinating, but also the creatures that you work with. So you've come with a little friend.
I have.
who will help us explore the idea of regeneration. What is this you have?
So this is a salamander, an axolotl. It's a Mexican salamander, almost extinct in the wild. So most of the axolotls that are on the planet now are either pets or working in labs.
And salamanders are that part of that group of animals that are able to regenerate. Can you tell me a little bit about how this developed and why it's of a benefit evolutionarily?
Yeah, so a lot of animals can regenerate. So invertebrates are particularly good at it, like spiders and tarantulas and crabs. If they lose a limb, when they molt again, they can replace that limb. It's very basic. A lot of flatworms, you can cut them into several pieces and they'll regenerate into fully grown flatworms. The myth of the earthworm, if you chop it in half, you'll get two worms. That's not true. One half will live, the other half will die. The half with the mouth will survive. When you get into vertebrates, though, regeneration isn't really a big thing. And invertebrates, of course, include ourselves. What tends to happen when a vertebrate loses a limb is you get a scar tissue forming, and that's it. So even if I lost my arm now, hopefully I'd go and see a doctor and they'd patch it up, but I'd have a skin-covered stump. With the amphibians, particularly the salamanders, they have kind of the last vertebrate ability to hold on to that regeneration, and they number one champion of it is the axolotl, who I have in this little tub here.
So give us an idea of how good at regeneration this animal is. What could, not that we should do anything to it, but in the wild, what sort of insults could it survive?
So basically they're the Wolverines of the amphibian world, for all you Marvel fans out there. They can have part of their brain crushed, their spinal cord crushed, limbs taken off, tails taken off, eyes poked out, and within 3 months, they'll have grown them back.
Wow.
So you're talking about an incredible creature that can do nearly, it's almost like unbelievable how much repair they can do to their own bodies, particularly when you're talking about spinal cord, severing a spinal cord, crushing it. We all know how devastating an injury like that can be to people or to animals, but no bother to these guys.
There's obviously a cost benefit to any trait that you have adapted over several generations of evolution. And you imagine that growing back an arm would cost a lot. And so what is the benefit of very slowly being able to grow that arm back over time?
Well, I suppose if you're looking at it from the axolotls or the salamander's point of view, it's you're not going to be as vulnerable if you have all your limbs back. Mm. The question is why higher vertebrates can't do that. It kind of
I love how everyone's asking better questions than I'm asking. I told you that would happen. That is the right question.
Yeah, it kind of stops at crocodilians. Lizards control their tails. Their tails flip around. If a predator, if I do research with Irish lizards and if you spook them, they control their tail and it basically has a nerve in it, flips around, distracts the bird or the predator that's attacking the lizard.
Oh, so they actually self-sever.
Self-sever.
Mm. Wow.
And then the lizard runs away and the bird has a tail for a meal. Crocodilians, if their tail is bitten off by another crocodile, we've seen in captivity that they can grow back their tail somewhat, but it's not as good as what the salamanders can do. So that's kind of the line in vertebrates as to, you know, the ability to regenerate stops. Mammals don't do it, birds don't do it.
Is that, I'm not sure if this is the correct term, is that because of the metabolic cost of, you know, growing back something big, you just can't?
We don't know.
Yeah.
That's the answer. We don't know. There's theories that it might be because when you get into warm-blooded mammals and higher up on the evolutionary scale, that it could cause cancerous growth, but there's no real definite answer. Now, we have mapped the genome of the axolotl, so that might give some kind of answers down the line. There's a lot of research into it, because as you can imagine, the ability, if we could unlock the key to growing back limbs, it would be very beneficial to a lot of people. But the answer to your question is that we really don't know at the moment.
So, we start from stem cells, embryonic stem cells, and these cells differentiate as they encounter different stimuli in different environment, right? Is that what's happening at the end of the axolotl's arm? If it's cut off, is it just a whole layer of stem cells that sort of grow based on what's behind it?
Hit the nail. That's exactly it, because it's basically what happens is when we get it, lose an arm or a leg, your body heals and you get scar tissue over it. And we do regenerate to a certain degree. If you cut yourself shaving, you are kind of healing to a small degree. But with the axolotl, when it loses a limb, it forms a blastoma, and it's kind of like it switches the cells that rush to that part of the body back into their younger self. So basically stem cells. And then they, instead of forming scar tissues, they start reproducing bone, muscle, skin, pigment.
Bone?
Everything, yes. So the whole thing grows back. Yeah. It's not just like a floppy arm hanging there. So it does have the whole bone structure in there. And the same goes
of course it does, actually, now that I think about it.
Can I ask a physicist question here? Is this like, are all bones the same in different animals? So could the technology for growing a bone in your little amphibian there be used to help grow like a bone for a mammal?
I don't know.
I mean,
the answer to
I
that.
Think that when we take IP, when we take cells, I mean, we do have technology now where we take cells out of humans and we reprogram them back to their embryonic state, and then we try to use that to maybe grow implants that could go back into that human. But what's amazing about the axolotl is that it's doing all that internally.
Yeah.
I don't know about the axolotl, but a lot of these things as well, they have way bigger genomes than us. They have much more complex genomes. I think 10 times our size or something.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. So like, these are hugely complex animals.
Oh, right. Because I was my next question was going to be, don't we have these genes in us anyway? Couldn't it be just a matter of flipping it on so you can grow your arm back?
This is what they're looking into. So when you have a genome of this animal, you can kind of go deep into it and see what works to switch these cells back into, instead of forming scar tissue, that they'll, you know, if we could do it in us, it wouldn't form scar tissue, it would form stem cells that would rush and repair your arm. Now, the difference between, obviously, ourselves and an amphibian, it would take 3 months for an amphibian to grow back an arm, maybe 6 months if it's not being fed right. Nutrition has a lot to do with it. But it would take a year for a person to grow back an arm if you were to scale it up. So
That would I wouldn't mind, though. If I lost my arm, a year would be fine. You're waiting a year to get an appointment to the hospital anyway.
So we just fixed the health crisis, basically. So we just grow it all back yourself.
Just grow it all back. Yeah, exactly. Here's some stem cells. See you in a year. So, Aideen, obviously, you know, with these creatures being so endangered, it does bring up the, you know, the idea that regeneration of animals is fine, but we also need to look after the environments that they're in. Tell me a little bit, about your work and what it is that you research.
Yeah, so I am interested in wetland restoration through irrigation. So basically we have a wetland, it's drying out a little bit. What can we do? Well, our first answer was we'll put on a bit more water and see if that helps.
More water.
More water for the snails and Sligo. That's what I look at. So what I'm interested in is it's similar to a bog. It's called a fen, but instead of having stagnant water, it has water that runs through it. And wetlands are extremely important just ecologically. They're one of our most endangered habitats. But like you were saying, for animals that rely on these type of systems as well. So wetlands support a lot of endangered and rare species and migratory bird species. So we can't really say, oh, we need to protect the animals. We need to protect the animals without giving them a place to live. And not only do they need a place to live, they need a place that will support them long term, not just for one or two generations, but for all generations to come.
So when it comes to something like a wetland, presumably that requires quite a lot of water. How do you re-wet a wetland that's gone dry?
There's different ways. Generally, we try and catch them before they've gone too far, before they've turned more into a grassland where they're dominated by one, two species, really not biodiverse and have gone quite dry. That takes a lot more resources. It takes a lot more money. And then again, you're trying to find the right water to put back into that system. With my research, I've been quite lucky that we have a site in Sligo. It's Loch Tult near Tubbercurry. And we noticed that ecologically, everything seemed perfectly fine, but hydrologically, it wasn't. And the only reason we found that out was because a rare species of snail that lives there is no longer there. And that relies on hydrological stability.
Sorry, so, can I just ask a question, right?
Of course.
Who is out in the wetlands of Sligo trying to spot snails? I mean, it's great
myself,
that someone's doing that, right? But if I had to choose, I was given a science degree and I choose whatever you want to do, that's not what I would choose to do at my time.
Yeah, I just said earlier that's something I'd love to do when we were chatting before the show.
But you're weird, Shane. Yeah.
What does that say about me that I'm the one actually doing it then?
Uh-oh. It's okay when I slag Shane, but you guess that's not great. So, but genuinely, why? How on earth did you get to the stage where you were like, I better check that wetland and see if it's getting a little bit dry?
So I didn't actually discover that the snail was gone. One of my supervisors, Evelyn Morkins, did. So the site is a special area of conservation.
Okay.
And one of the qualifying features of that is to have Vertigo gyrite, the snail, there. And they have done surveys throughout the years, dating back to the 1997. They started these surveys and the snail was found. Then in 2007, they did another survey and it wasn't there anymore. So what resulted in that was me with a PhD project. But it also resulted in the first iropi project granted in Ireland under the Habitats Directive. So iropi is imperative reasons of overriding public importance. And what that means is we can continue to take water from the habitat, even though it's damaging a little bit, so long as we mitigate the impacts, which is me adding the irrigation, up until a point that we find a new water source that 13,000 people rely on, so they can use that again. So it wasn't necessarily me out there looking for these snails. It was...
Somebody was.
So
what's the best way of restoring an ecological system? Because, you know, in this particular instance, just add water is one thing. And obviously finding a reliable source and enough water, it can be problematic. But are there other ways in other ecological systems where you have to use different techniques to try and restore something that's once been lost?
Yeah, there's loads of different techniques. So like I said, in my case, we just add water on top. But sometimes the system's gone too far and we have to block up the drains that are pulling too much water out. So we can block them up to keep it a bit wet. Or sometimes ditches are dug and they're flooded. And then that way the water can leach back into the habitat again. It's really a case by case situation. You have to understand what's gone wrong in order to fix it. So it's not always as simple as just a wetland's drying out, we'll just throw some water up because it's drying out for a certain reason. And adding more water to it will just mean it'll run off even more. So we need to figure out what's gone wrong, where it's gone wrong, and then we can start to understand what we can do to repair it, if it's adding water, or it could be adding different species there to control the habitat a bit more so it can retain the water.
In terms of ecological effects, can introducing a species have a big effect on an environment?
Yeah, of course it can. And we run a lot into these issues when we talk about invasive species and invasive aliens. Collie's nodding his head. He does.
Yep. Like goats, I suppose. Goats are a big problem, and sheep in Ireland, right?
Deer. Yeah. We have so many different species of introduced deer. And like you were saying about saving different ecological areas, you look at our national parks, they're being eaten alive by invasive deer and goats. And, you know, a simple solution is to just get the places fenced off so the animals can't get in, or have a cull of the invasive species. You know,
or reintroduce a predator.
Yeah, or reintroduce a predator.
That would be way more fun.
All of which, you know, kind of seems very far-fetched, and some people kind of are uncomfortable with these solutions, but they are necessary in order to really restore an ecosystem that we are on the verge of losing.
Yeah. Has there been a really successful example of this anywhere?
One that springs to mind is the Abbey Leaks Bog up in Laois. So the bog was set to be drained and harvested, and the community that lived there were appalled by this. So they approached Bord na Mona and they came to an agreement that they could restore the bog to its previous ecological functions. I think they have a 50-year lease, but I feel like it'll be extended. I don't think they'll be able to take the bog back. But that's a community-led restoration project, and it's quite rare because restoration takes a lot of time and resources and energy to do. But that would be probably the biggest one that comes to mind. Now they have like the butterflies that were no longer there coming back because the plants are growing and it has the habitat to support them again. So that would kind of be the biggest one that springs to mind. And then in terms of like animals, we've got the red kites that were reintroduced. We've even got some up, I think, now around Pulbeg Towers. So they're doing quite well. But I think the Abbey Leaks Bog would be the biggest restoration that comes to mind, yeah.
And just before we let you go, Aideen, is there anything people in the room or people listening at home can do if they encounter a habitat that they have been to regularly and is starting to degrade? What can they do?
Well, they can contact the county councils and see what's going on there. You can even look, even just Google it. You might be surprised that there actually is research going on in that area to begin with. Or the area might be designated, like the Abbey Leaks Bog, to be destroyed and you just didn't know. And that's why it's kind of been left to go to wreck and ruin. But reaching out to the community as well. So the more people that you have, the more people who are educated on this, the more people you can get in your corner to protect habitats is really what you need. It's a stronghold that we need.
Kick up a bit of fuss for nature. Sometimes you have to get your local community together. And we've had great success. I work with the Herpetological Society of Ireland, and we've come across little gems of biodiversity, places like Tala, places in the Midlands as well, that we've helped communities stand up for themselves and say, no, we want this to be left alone for nature. Yeah. And it is important. Abbey Leaks Bog is a brilliant example of it. And we need more people like that to stand up and take action, because the government sometimes doesn't.
Yeah. So. All right. Collie Ennis, Aideen McAdams, thank you very much. Okay.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.